was Kingston Prison by James McKenty. James joins me tonight on Dangerfield on 101.5 FM The Hawk. So James, that was a song that we just heard. If people want to buy it, they can go to seventhfirerecords.com. And so that was a 7-inch that was produced by Greg Keeler, correct? And can you talk a little bit about when that came out and what that recording process was like?
Sure. Yeah, that was about, I'll be guessing at this point, but I'd say about 8 years ago. And yeah. Me and the drummer, Tommy Street, and Josh Robichaud, the bass player from my band, The Spades, we had a little record club where if you joined, you got a 7-inch record in the mail every month. And so a lot of those we were recording other artists at our studio. And it was actually Tom Street, who really runs that label, said, well, you should do one of these. And I realized, you know, I wouldn't be able to complete it in time if I tried to do it on my own. And so I asked Greg if he'd help me do it. And it was really fun. We just recorded at his house where, you know, we've done lots of stuff together there. So it was very relaxed. And Tom Street, the drummer and record label owner, ended up playing drums, and we just sort of put it together there at the farm.
Cool, yeah. And actually at that website, seventhfirerecords.com, there's some other great releases on there as well. I saw that there was one by Melissa Payne and a couple of other great ones. So if people want to check that out, they should definitely go look into that. So we touched upon Greg Keeler there. So Greg actually has said some pretty great things about you. So he worked on that album with you. You've actually recently worked on a ton of stuff with him. So I'm going to read a quote by one thing that he said. He said something about you that says an engineer's job is to get the best possible sounds and know when to speak up and when not to. James' contribution on both levels is tremendous. James is an artist and has the great gift of being able to combine the science and the art of recording. So James, you just recently worked on Greg Keeler's solo album called Share the Love. And there's kind of a bit of an interesting story behind that, in that there were two versions of that album that came out. And so can you talk a little bit about the one that came out first? And it was recorded at a place called Gore's Landing. And maybe you could take us through kind of the story of the two releases and how that all came about.
Sure. Yeah. It is very unique. And, you know, I still kind of get a chuckle out of it just because you couldn't plan it this way. But we basically went into Greg's farmhouse to start his solo album there. And over the course of, it was probably 5 months, maybe 6 months here and there, little patches of time, we would get together and reconvene at his place and record a studio record. But when it came time to do promo for that record, it was decided that, well, Greg wanted to put the band together and film the band live performing those songs. So I had been going out to this little hall in Gore's Landing and doing a few recordings. So I said, you know, come and take a look at that place. It could be ideal. You know, it's a beautiful small town hall, hardwood floors, and seemed good for filming. So we put the band in there and over 2 days recorded all the songs from the album. But where it gets strange is that Greg liked the live version better than the studio version. And then it was sent to Warner Brothers, the record label, and the folks at the record label liked the live version better than the studio version. So the live version really became the album. And that's what got released. And so it was crazy. It was almost like the studio version was like pre-production in a way. It's like where everyone developed their parts. So by the time we got to doing it at the hall, everyone had very specific parts and had rehearsed their parts. So I think we were doing like one, maybe two takes per song. And then choosing which one might be, you know, 5% better, but it really just happened so fast.
And I kind of remember like reading about how, you know, had you gone into it thinking that was the album, it would have been a totally different result, but it kind of ended up being that almost, yeah, by accident, which is kind of cool. And there's actually some great film footage of that as well, that kind of came out as a bit of a companion piece. And then I believe that on Record Store Day, then the original, what was supposed to be the original version, came out as well. So for those who want to check it out, there's both versions are out there and available. What song would you like to hear off that? Maybe let's play a song off the live version, which is do you have a preference or should we just
listen? Yeah. You know what? I like the tune Feather Witch.
Oh, cool. Yeah. That's great. Okay, let's listen to Feather Witch off of Share the Love by Greg Keeler and recorded by James McKenty. Feather Witch by Greg Keeler off the album Share the Love. And James McKenty, who worked on that album and played on that album, joins me tonight on Dangerfield. So James, we were talking a little bit about recording and you know, I read that you've been kind of recording since you were a young kid. So you started off with, I guess, a 4-track recorder out in a shed. And now you've kind of, I think, come up in the world in the sense where you've got something that I would say is a little bit nicer than a shed. You've got a really, really cool studio that you just built. It's called In Record Time Studio, and it's out of an Airstream mobile. So can you take us through a little bit about, you know, how that came to be and what that building, that studio was like?
For sure. Yeah. That came about because my wife and I sat around maybe 5 years ago in the kitchen, you know, making dinner. And it was like, we were talking about, at that time we were doing a lot of events that we would record. So we'd bring a band into this barn outside of Peterborough, and we would bus the guests in, and they wouldn't know who they were going to see. And my wife does, she's a chef, so she'd do catering. So she'd do the food side, I'd do the music. And we were constantly hauling the equipment around to different things. And somehow it came around to, wouldn't it be great if the equipment was just in an Airstream trailer and we just hitched it on the back of a truck and brought it wherever we went for these events, you know? And I'd sort of, in a lot of ways, been recording mobile for the last 8 years or so, you know, like even when I go to Greg's house, I'm bringing my equipment there. And so, it just sort of snowballed. And then we found a retired couple outside of town that had one in really great shape. So the bones were there, the structure was really solid. And luckily we found a local designer that, I think he's used to doing, you know, industrial design and homes and stuff, but he really drew up a plan of how we could fit this equipment in there, make people comfortable. And it took, you know, a couple years of planning and gutting it and redoing it, but everything was torn out of it and put back together to be purpose built as a studio and a lounge on wheels.
That's amazing. And didn't you kind of almost premiere the unveiling of it a bit this summer at the Peterborough Folk Fest?
The Peterborough Folk Fest sort of approached us because they had seen, you know, postings of it getting built and stuff, and they said, you know, we can't do the festival this year the way we normally do, which is a free festival at a downtown location, but they wanted to do a smaller event with still the same quality of acts, but film it. And so there would be something long lasting after, you know, because for the actual shows during COVID, they could only have so many people at the shows themselves. So there is a film being worked on, and that was, it was the unveiling of the trailer, and there was amazing acts, Donovan Wood, William Prince, Greg Keeler came, Melissa Payne, Tara Lightfoot. Like they really put it together beautifully.
That's a great christening for an awesome studio. So for those who want to check out the studio, you can find it at instagram.com/inrecordtimestudio. And James, who joins me tonight, you can find his music and more about him on jamesmckenty.com. That's McKenty, jamesmckenty.com. So James, you touched a little bit before when we were chatting about some of the event production. So you mentioned that you also do some event work. And so take us through some of the artists. You mentioned you would do kind of surprise shows. I saw that you've done some work with everyone from Daniel Romano to the Rio Static. So what was that kind of selection process like for you? So how did you kind of decide which artists you were going to be working with for those events?
Yeah, for the events that we were doing just outside of town here, I guess you'd call them secret shows. A lot of the times those were friends, people that we knew that we could just get on the phone and say, okay, it's kind of a unique thing. Are you into this? You know, and everyone that would go to those shows would get a copy of that artist's latest album. And that was sort of how the artist got paid as well. It was like, we are going to buy 150 copies of your album, and everyone that leaves the party will have it.
Oh,
and
that's so really neat.
Yeah, it was quite fun. And so for that, we had, you know, like the Silver Hearts, who were a great local band around here, and Ginger St. James from Hamilton, and Devin Cuddy, Jim Cuddy's son. And it was all sort of personal, you know, it was like, that was all phone call stuff. And then somehow, you know, I got tied in with this hall in Omimi, after Neil Young played there. A lot of the local people thought that the hall should be used more often for music. So I sort of said, okay, I'll try to book some shows for you here. And that's where I brought the Rio Statics and, cool. And Donovan Woods. And that was just sort of getting off the ground, when COVID happened. So, we're just starting to talk about trying to ramp that back up, but a beautiful hall with a balcony, and it was designed by the same guy that designed Massey Hall. So it has all this rich history, but it wasn't being used much.
And did they, so I've been to, when they used to have Youngstown Museum in Omimi, which was the Neil Young kind of, museum, did they move some of those artifacts into the Omimi Hall? Is that correct? Or where did that stuff go? Do you know?
Do you mean from the Neil Young show?
Yeah, from the Neil Young Museum. So, you know, that place Youngstown that you
said,
did some of that stuff end up going into the Omimi Hall, or I can't
remember. No, you would actually, that would have been really smart, but no, that stuff didn't end up there. In fact, I remember going to, if you can believe it,
yeah,
a garage sale at that hall of the stuff from the museum. So they
maybe that's what I'm thinking of. Right. Cause I went to the Youngstown Museum a couple times, and I think right before one of the last times I went, they were about to be moving the stuff there. So that's where I'm getting confused. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. Right. No, a lot of that they sold off, which was, right. I mean, it was one of the more interesting garage sales I've been to.
Seriously. I mean, I got a great poster from the museum that's hangs on my wall that I love.
Beautiful.
And speaking of Neil Young, so you had quite an interesting experience with him and with his brother, Bob. So take us through that. So I know that you recorded a song with Bob and some of the Sadies and I think Melissa Payne. And then so take us through that story, because this is a pretty fascinating one.
Yeah. I mean, first off, I got to say that Neil has been, you know, he's been my guy since I was a teenager. This is part of why I started playing guitar. Mm-hmm. So, you know, big fan. But yes, I'd recorded his brother Bob, and Bob had a song about America, and it was political, and it was just strange. It was like COVID did me a favor this time, because then I think Neil, you know, he escaped back to Canada for a period of time, and he was around. And on my birthday, October 1st, I got up, and my wife had bought me the new Neil Young book on high-end audio, digital audio, and his quest, you know, for online music to be of a better fidelity. And she said, what do you want to do for your birthday? And I said, I want to talk to Neil, but I was really just joking.
Right.
But it was that day I got a call around 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and it's Neil, and he's saying, I want to add harmonica and vocal to my brother's song. And I'm like, yeah, sure. And his first question was, this is really geeky tech stuff, but what resolution did you record this at? And I recorded it at the highest possible resolution, because I thought if Neil ever asked this question, this is like in a dream, I want to have the right answer. So I told him, and he's like, okay, good man. Really happy about that. Thank you very much. When can we do it? You know? And it was pretty quick. I think it was like the next week we got together again out at Gore's Landing at that little hall. And, you know, Daryl Hannah was with him, and she was pretty specific that she didn't want a lot of people there. So it was really small. And it was great. He came in, and he was very organized. He was like, there's 5 things I want to do. I want to do this edit. I want to sing this. I want Melissa to sing this. And it was awesome. Wow,
that's amazing. And so I recall seeing footage of that, like on video, like I think I saw that posted. And is that song available to purchase online? Do you know?
I don't know that it's available for purchase. Yeah. I believe it's just Neil put it up on his YouTube channel. And I think that's sort of where it landed.
Mm-hmm.
But it does have footage of the hall, and it starts with the Canadian flag waving outside. It's all very, you know, Ontario, small town. It's kind of nice the way they put it together.
That's awesome. So for those just joining or listening to Dangerfield on 101.5 The Hawk FM, and James McKenty joins me tonight. And so James, I was looking back. So I keep like a listing of all the shows I go to, and I was looking back and I was like, I remember going to see the Spades, your former band. And I looked up and I saw that I saw you twice in 2007. Once was at the Key to Bala opening for Sam Roberts' band. And the other was at the Metro Convention Center with Pete Elkiss at the Grey Cup kickoff party.
Oh my gosh. I remember. I remember both of those. But yeah, the Grey Cup one, that sticks out as one of the strangest.
Right. Shows. the big room, and it was so funny because I was like, I remember the last time I saw you, I was like, I remember going to see your band. And so it's fun to have those kind of the archive. Do you keep track of kind of the shows you see or the shows you play? Like do you kind of keep like archives of any of that kind of stuff?
You know, I don't, and I'm really bad with dates and dates even down to years. You know, if you were to say, oh, like, when was that Cuff the Duke album? I would just be completely lost. But I do keep ticket stubs from stuff, yes, like shows that I've been to, you know, and I've seen some like great shows. Like Ray Charles was amazing. And I saw James Brown. Like, I keep that stuff.
Well, but for my own. Yeah, I was just going to say, do you find, because I keep a ticket stub collection as well, but there's a certain era of stubs where the ink's fading. I don't know if you've noticed that.
For sure.
But so some of them, it's almost like, you know, it's like that Back to the Future scene or whatever, where like it's just fading away before.
The things are erasing before your eyes.
So I've had to like write on the back of them what they are. But, and I know of some people who frame their stubs, you can actually buy like glass frame that kind of refracts light. So if you hang something on the wall that you don't want to fade, there's certain glass you can get that that doesn't soak in the light, which is kind of neat.
Oh, that's cool. That's smart.
Yeah. And so speaking of the Spades then, so you recorded a couple of albums with the producer on your album was Gord Sinclair. And it's kind of like, there seems to be a bit of a trend with you here where people will record you or work with you. And then, you know, I guess the relationship goes so well that you end up working with them. So you, not only did you work with Gord Sinclair, but then you recently in, I guess, 2020, you recorded and mixed his album. Is that correct?
Yeah. Gord, when the Spades were getting going, we would play every Wednesday at the Merchant McLeam at the bottom of Princess. And Gord came out to one of those shows. That's how we met. And they have a great studio, the guys from the Tragically Hip in Bath, the Bat House. Mm-hmm. And so he sort of offered up to help us and produce. And we just became really good buds. And they're just all like, you know, from my interaction with anyone from that band, they're all kind of like salt of the earth. There's just great people. And so it's kind of nice that it came back around, you know, like I think Gord, he was always writing songs. But you know, that band was like a machine. It was a huge thing. And all the focus went towards that and touring and new albums. So in the last few years, I think Gord's been really enjoying just recording his songs. And we did a mini tour together opening for the Trues. And we're actually recording a new album for him right now.
Nice.
Number two. Yeah.
And then you, your band, the Spades, you did a tour opening for the Hip, correct? What tour, what tour was that for the Hip that you went on?
We actually, we never did a full coast to coast tour, but we did festivals with them. So,
okay.
You know, the first one was Sarnia Bayfield. And I mean, that's sort of up there for me of just highlights of shows, because we hadn't released our first album. And the night before we played to like 50 people, and then we played to like 16,000. Wow. There was no ramp up. It was just like one night we were doing this, the next night we're doing this. And so, yeah, we did a bunch of festivals with them.
That's awesome. And so you've got some, like, you know, you've got some really amazing stories. So one thing I wanted to ask you, so were you involved? So you had this bit of a cryptic post on your blog, on your website, which is jamesmckinty.com, and it's referencing working with like a song from outer space. Was that the actual Chris Hadfield song?
No. And I know it's funny. Oh gosh, I'm going to forget his name. But Gord Sinclair is really good friends with an astronaut. Yeah. And he was up there and he would do his tracks there, send them down, and we would do Gord's tracks down here. And I was thinking, this is crazy. We're sending files to outer space. And then I thought, you know what? The Wi-Fi is probably really good up there. Like, maybe this isn't that crazy. It's probably better than we have.
That's amazing. Oh my goodness. And so, so another question that I have for you. So there's, let's listen to this song. Me and Bobby McGee, featuring Willie Nelson, Lightfoot, and Ronnie Hawkins. And then we're going to come back and we'll chat about that. Okay.
Sounds good.
Busted flat in Baton Rouge and heading for the train. Feeling early faded as my jeans. Bobby thumbed the diesel down just before it rained. Took us all the way to New Orleans. I pulled my harpoon out of my dirty red bandana. Growing sad while Bobby sang the blues. Them windshield wipers slapping time. Bobby clapping hands. We finally sang up every song that driver knew. Freedom just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing ain't worth nothing but it's free. Feeling good was easy, Lord, when Bobby sang the blues. Buddy, that was good enough for me. Good enough for me and my Bobby McGee. From the coal mines of Kentucky to the California sun, Bobby shared the secrets of my soul. Standing right beside me, Lord, through everything I've done. Every night she kept me from the cold. Somewhere near Selena's, Lord, I let her slip away. Searching for a home I hope she finds. I trade all my tomorrows for one single yesterday. Holding Bobby's body next to mine. Freedom just another word for nothing left to lose. Nothing ain't worth nothing but it's free. Feeling good was easy, Lord, when Bobby sang the blues. Buddy, that was good enough for me. Janice, good enough for me, my Bobby McGee. La 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 la. La, 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 me and Bobby McGee. La 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 la. Me and Bobby McGee.
One more time.
La 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 la. Me and Bobby McGee.
That was Me and Bobby McGee by Kris Kristofferson, featuring Willie Nelson, Gordon Lightfoot, and Ronnie Hawkins. And so James McKinty, musician, engineer, producer, joins me tonight on Dangerfield. So can you talk to us a little bit about this crazy story of yours? That's what you want to share.
Yeah, Gordon Lightfoot and Ronnie Hawkins go way back. You know, they were playing the Toronto scene at the same time in the 60s. And I think Gordon used to do his shows and then go over to watch Ronnie and the band, Levon and the Hawks, after. And so they've been friends. And backstage at the Havelock Jamboree, I guess they had a conversation where we should record something together. And that was sort of the seed of the idea. And Ronnie is also friends with Chris Christopherson, who said, I'd like to come and visit. And I don't know, I guess Ronnie must have said, we're recording this song. And Chris was like, okay, I'll come down for that. And so I brought the equipment out to Ronnie Hawkins' place. He was living on Stony Lake at the time. And we just set up in his living room, and I played guitar, and the Weber brothers played bass and guitar. And this great drummer, Steve, came in, and he had this amazing groove for it. And we just played it live, recorded that, and then put Ronnie's vocal on it. And that was sort of day one. And then the next day, Gordon popped by to visit. I don't think he anticipated to sing, but Chris came, and Chris did his vocal. And then Gordon Lightfoot did his vocal. And Gordon Lightfoot is such an amazing guy in the studio, because you picture him as a folky, as a finger picking acoustic guy, but he will write charts out for drums or for anything. He will chart out in musical notation what he thinks might be the right part. And so I started calling him the teacher, because he would almost direct people on, you know, their part a little bit. Huh. And it was very cool. And so afterwards, I had communication with Chris Christopherson's wife, who had filmed it. And I just kind of went out of my comfort zone. And I was like, we got four verses and three singers. Wouldn't it be great if Willie Nelson did a verse? And she said, we're backstage with him right now. I'll ask him.
No way.
And I was, yeah, I just felt like the biggest doofus ever, but I couldn't stop myself, because I sort of knew they were on tour together. And I had bought tickets to one of the shows outside of Chicago. And she said, well, Willie's in. Where do you want to do it? And I said, I'm already coming to the show in Chicago. We'll do it backstage. So we set up on his bus, and he did his first there.
So you've been on his famous bus.
Yes. Yeah. And I went with my wife, Kelly, and son, Noah. Uh-huh. And we drove, and we made a little vacation out of it. And we just hauled the equipment in the back of our little Honda Civic. And when we got there, you know, I was the only one really allowed to go on the bus. So Kelly and Noah just hung out on Chris Christopherson's bus until I was done. And then we watched the show, and Willie just did it in one take. And I think he wanted me to point at him when his verse came.
Right.
So I pointed at him. I was like, this is where your verse is going to be. And I pointed at him, and he just started singing. And then afterwards he was like, did you record that? And I said, yeah. And he goes, what do you think? And I was like, I think we're done. Like, it was amazing.
That would be like one of the only times when you're like coming back and crossing the border, and you really want to get interrogated by the border crossing people asking you what you've been up to.
Yeah. I even switched Kelly into the driver's seat as we went over.
Yeah.
To make so that, you know, it would look like a little family vacation. What are you guys doing? We're just going to a little concert, you know, because I was like, I don't want to get caught at the border with this equipment and a bunch of questions.
Exactly. That's
and so Kelly was like, we're just going on vacation. And the guy was like, if you're going to Chicago, you should go to this and you should go to this. And he dragged it on for like 15 minutes. And I was sitting there being like, please just let us go.
Let us go. Let us go. Yeah. And so speaking of kind of like, you know, all the music studios and your love of them. So are you someone who goes and visits kind of, you know, studios in the States or you know, across Canada? Like what's been kind of your best studio visit that you've ever been to besides your own?
Well, you know what? I really found a beauty in the setup that the Tragically Hip had in Bath, because it was a farmhouse. Mm-hmm. And there was bedrooms upstairs and a room with records and a pool table, and you ate your meals together, and you know, you're 15, 20 minutes from a town. So it's not like you're going out to the bars at night. Like it's just so directed. Right. It directs you towards the music and staying in it. And I loved that. And I think that's why I also loved it when Greg called Keeler to record at his place because I was like, this is familiar, right? We're in a house.
Right. So
we'll put the amps in the washroom and we'll put the drums in the living room. And so I always loved that sort of aesthetic. And I mean, there's other beautiful studios that I feel lucky to have been in, like Revolution in Toronto. Mm-hmm. But that to me is almost daunting. It's just such a massive space.
Right. Yeah. The bathroom one reminds me of like the Motown Museum, the famous bathroom set up there. Right.
Yeah. Like that. I've wanted to go and see that and I haven't yet, which is kind of ridiculous because it's not that far away, but it's on my list of things to see.
Nice. And so you've got a really cool thing as well. So I guess it was maybe last Christmas. And sorry, for those that are just joining, we're talking to James McKenty tonight on Dangerfield. So you can find his stuff at jamesmckenty.com or his music studio at instagram.com/inrecordtimestudios. And so you last year did something really cool where you have a custom vinyl maker. Can you talk a little bit about that and what that's all about?
Yeah, that sort of came out of the Airstream mobile studio idea. Mm-hmm. You know, once we had that idea cooking and the studio was just about done and we were going to have this trailer and be able to hit the road, I looked at it sort of like an Alan Lomax, you know, type scenario where it's like we could field record people anywhere. We could run cables to mm-hmm. a front step, into a hall, you know, go to the East Coast and do a kitchen party and run the mics around the kitchen And then all of a sudden, one day I saw this record lathe from the 1930s. So it cuts vinyl records and it's tube driven and it folds up like a little suitcase. And so in my little dream state, it was like, well, the studio is called In Record Time.
Right.
If we could make records live in real time, I was like, we got to have this thing. We got to get it.
Yeah, that's awesome. And where did you find that?
It was for sale. It was listed in Toronto. I was part of a Facebook group of audio engineers and there would be stuff for sale there. Mm-hmm. It's a bit addictive, but that came up. And it's funny. It's not the first record lathe that I've had around. We had another one that was about the size of a small fridge. It was massive. Mm-hmm. And I never really got on to how to using it. But this one, I was like, well, it's really simplified and it's so compact. So I bought it and I bought a few boxes of blank records. And then last Christmas, I offered it to some people online, you know, does anyone want some records made for presents? And was just bombarded for about 2 weeks. And I'm not kidding you. I was on my hands and knees cutting cardboard sleeves. Like I was making it from scratch.
Right.
And every time someone sent an album, it needs to be done in real time, which means I need to sort of master it a bit. Mm-hmm. Put the record on the blank, drop the needle, start their music. And then I have to listen to all of it from beginning to end. So if the album is 25, 30 minutes long and they want two copies, it's probably going to take me an hour and a half.
So I didn't realize it was more than just like one song. Like you were doing like albums with it.
Yeah, I was. And although the original idea really was to do 7-inch and have people walk into the trailer mm-hmm. and sit at a single microphone because the record lathe is mono, mm-hmm. just run a single microphone. So if they sit on the bench in the trailer and they sing their song, I can literally just pick up the record and hand it to them and they're back out the door. It's like a recording booth on wheels.
Wow, that's really cool.
But I did offer it to people and a lot of indie artists that hadn't heard their music on vinyl wanted their whole album. So I was doing 12-inch records and it was very time consuming.
That's a lot of work.
It was fun though. I loved it.
That's cool. So you had a pretty interesting experience as well. So we were talking about mixing before and you had a really cool thing that I read about where you went over to France. Can you talk a little bit about that where you did something called Mix with the Masters?
Yeah. I had been following this mixing engineer. you know, so there's folks that obviously do all of this. They record the artist, or they produce and they mix. But this gentleman's name was Tom Elmhurst, and he's really just focused on mixing albums for people. And he had done the Amy Winehouse Back to Black album, and Beck, and sort of all these artists that I loved that somehow were sounding contemporary, but at the same time sounding like it came out of the 60s or 70s.
Right.
And so I sort of became enthralled with the way these records sounded. And I found out he was doing this week-long class in the south of France. And you had to sort of submit examples of your work online and a bio. And I think in the end, they chose 15 people from all over the place. Yeah. And it was pretty crazy, because I didn't tell my wife I even submitted this stuff, because I didn't think my name would get chosen. And then when it did, I had to explain to her, I need to come up with a lot of dough and I need to get to the south of France.
No, and so what were the other people like? Like, what kind of a group of people was that? And was it, and like, what kind of conversations did you have with those people? Like, that must have been such an interesting group of folks.
It was, you know, there was someone from Japan, there was someone from Australia, and it was in this, it looked like a mansion, but really it had been a factory where they had done Napoleon's army's jackets, I guess, is what they used to make there. And now it had been turned into a studio, and like Radiohead had been there, and it has, couldn't tell you, maybe 20 something bedrooms.
Okay.
And so the deal is you get up in the morning and you're out on this lawn and you all eat breakfast together and all the food was included. And then you go into the studio portion of this big building, and he would listen to your work, and he would even remix some of your work while you're sitting there and explain what he was doing. And a lot of the takeaway I got from that was that he was mixing very fast.
Okay.
And I always felt like my best mixes were done fast, but then, you know, either your ego or something tells you to keep going at it. Uh-huh. And sometimes the results are diminishing rather than better. Right.
And circles after a bit, I guess, right?
Yeah, it's almost like your ears get fatigued and you start making decisions based on what you're seeing on a screen rather than what you're hearing. Or, you know, music's, especially rock and roll, it's meant to be fairly exciting. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we all know what happens when you go into a music club and you crank you stand in front of a band for 2 hours at full volume.
Right.
You know, your ears get a little muffly. You're not, yeah. You go home and your ears are ringing. Well, this is the same theory in mixing, where I think it's like after about 40 minutes, your brain is desensitized a little bit to what you're doing. So you have to work fast.
Okay.
You got to get it. You got to get in there and, you know, for lack of a better word, treat it like a sport. Like, get in there, start moving faders really fast and try to get something happening. And that's what it's about.
And how are your ears? Are your ears doing pretty good?
My ears are pretty good. In my little studio, I have the band behind me, and for 6 years in my space, I have to wear headphones when they're tracking. Mm-hmm. And I try not to put myself in that situation very much anymore. Headphones are kind of, that's one of the worst things, I think, for your ears is headphones. So I don't do a lot of full band stuff in my space anymore. I'll go to the hall where I can be in another room.
Right.
Yeah.
And I actually read a really, great quote that you said, where you said, recording really is just taking a picture of sound. And if the recording puts you somewhere else inside someone else's life and what was going on, I think that's the ultimate goal. I thought that was a really cool, cool quote. And you also said the room is also an instrument. So can you talk a little bit about maybe, like the most difficult room that you've ever worked in kind of sound wise?
Yeah, let me think about that. I've been in a few, 'cause I'm constantly, I'm constantly like, yeah, we'll record it at your house, you know. And then I get there and it's like, oh, low ceilings, that's not good for drums.
Right.
But for really challenging, you know, when the band stopped touring, my band the Spades, we got a really large schoolhouse near Havelock, Ontario, and it was 4,000 square feet. And it was beautiful, and we completely redid these into two rooms. So it was almost like the control room was as big as the live room. It was like, you know, almost 2,000 square feet of control room and 2,000 square feet of live room. But
that's huge.
It was huge, and it had these massive 14-foot-high windows that overlooked a field, and the neighbors' horses were always out there. But it was too lively. It was... you know, like a lot of people reference Led Zeppelin, when the levee breaks, the drums sound like they're in a cavern.
Yeah.
Well, everything kind of sounded like that, which is great when it's Led Zeppelin, you know, when the levee breaks, but it's not great when it's Melissa Payne on the fiddle. Yes. So we had to build a lot of big sound baffles at that space. And so when an artist was in there, you would build little virtual rooms inside of the larger room to cut the sound down. And I think I learned from that experience that for the most part, I like smaller rooms. Mm-hmm. Like you don't need to have a big, massive live studio unless you're doing orchestras to get some really nice sounds. So, yeah.
Cool. So for those just joining, we're talking to James McKenty tonight on Dangerfield, jamesmckenty.com. You can find out more info on him there. And his studio in Record Time Studio is also on Instagram. We're coming up on time here, but I wanted to maybe play another song that you worked on. So maybe let's play, maybe the Matt Barber album that you worked on. I thought that was pretty nice.
Sure. You know what? You're tapped into it. You're very timely because, just about to start another album with Matt at the end of this week. So that'd be awesome.
No way.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So maybe let's play a song off of, let's see.
No, maybe let's play If Our Timing Is True.
So this is If Our Timing Is True by Matt Barber off of the album Big Romance.
Will you be ready for me when I'm ready for you? In that moment will be if our timing is true. And will you answer my call when I am calling for you? Oh, you'll be just down the hall if our timing is true. If our timing is true. If our timing is true. Will be there when I call, darling, if our timing is true. If our timing is true. sun finally sets and we take our last breath, we will be one and not two. If our timing is true, if our timing, if our timing is true, we will be one and not two, darling. If our timing is true, if our timing is true, if our timing is, if our timing is, if our
that was If Our Timing Is True by Matt Barber off the album Big Romance. And James McKenzie joins me tonight. So James, you played electric guitar on that album. You also recorded and mixed it. And that album was produced by Gary Louris of the Jayhawks. And that, I think that was you recorded that back in 2014. So that's neat that you're going to be working with Matt again. Are you working on a full? Are you working at it up at your place or in the city? Or
yeah, we're going to do it at my little studio here in Peterborough, which is just beside my house. And awesome. I actually took Greg Keeler's old big vintage reel-to-reel tape machine, and we're going to do the album live to the tape machine.
Oh, that's exciting. Cool.
So, yeah, I'm really looking forward to it, not looking at a computer screen for a little while and just, you know.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I do my interviews now just on audio because I have to wear my bifocals pretty much.
And hey, you know what? I wanted to slip in and we didn't. But the fact that you nailed the cover for Greg's solo album that we were talking about earlier.
Oh, right. That's
right. I just feel like we didn't even mention it, but I remember, you know, Greg had the two versions of the album and you nailed it with the chalkboard art that you did for the live album. Yeah. So cool.
That's great. Thank you. That was fun to make. And yeah. And actually I think I made the video for, Black Feather. And I think there's actually a snippet of, I think it's you playing guitar solo. I kind of snuck in a little bit of little snippets of Gore's Landing in like one or two parts there.
I want to ask you how you did that video. I don't understand how you put that together.
I had no idea how to make a video and I just had to teach myself. So that was a learning curve, let me tell you.
That's impressive. Well done.
Thank you. Well, I guess I think we're running out of time here, James. That was super fun. I guess the only other question I wanted to ask you is if I've got time and hopefully I can squeeze it in, but the fact that you met Eddie Kramer once and I was reading up about I'm a big rock and roll fan and what was that experience like?
Yeah, I got asked to be a part of a panel of audio engineers that Eddie was on. And, I started learning guitar because I was a Hendrix fanatic and not on a small scale. I mean, I only listened to Jimi Hendrix for about 6 years straight when I first, you know, when I was 16, I was obsessed and I had live bootlegs and all that stuff. So that was a thrill to meet up with Eddie at this little panel of audio engineers. And he had the latest Electric Ladyland box set and he was showing off photos of his hanging with Jimmy. And it was just
amazing.
Perfect.
Well, James, thank you so much for joining tonight. And I encourage people to check out your website because there's so much cool stuff on there, jamesmckenzie.com. We barely touched on all the great artists that you've worked with, including Cuff the Duke, Michelle McAdory, Melissa Payne, just Devin Cuddy, the Silverhearts, the list goes on and on and on. you're a fantastically talented engineer and cool person. And thanks so much for joining me tonight. Okay.
Hey, nice to hang again.
Okay. Have a great night. Okay.
Take care. You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Broadcasting on campus at Mohawk College in Hamilton. This is CIOI-FM, 101.5 The Hawk.
Heard that you've been on the fence, all cause I love your bestest friend. Said to me you wanna cry, if I'm not there you won't survive. You're delirious, so serious, so poor boy, I got dry eyes. Feel inferior, be drearier, oh well. I see you fall apart, it's dark, it's you. Can't wait to fall apart, with you, with you. I see you fall apart, it's dark, it's you. Can't wait to fall apart with you.